Good morning. May it please the court. The district court committed legal error in holding the claim term resembling a pan-fried bacon product indefinite. Before I get to the merits, I want to address the jurisdictional issue Hormel has raised. The court has jurisdiction over this appeal. The district court only agreed to consider Hormel's indefiniteness claim or indefinite motion because Hormel represented in writing it would dismiss any remaining claims that a favorable indefiniteness ruling would, quote, end the case. The district court granted the summary judgment on June 24. Hormel could have immediately complied and filed a Rule 41C dismissal. In all events, 2 days later, HIP filed its notice of appeal. At that point in time, no genuine live issue remained in the case. The formal record then shows that HIP submitted an agreed proposed form of order on July 24, and the district court entered final judgment on July 25.
Okay. Why don't you proceed to the merits of the
Thank
case.
You, Your Honor. Returning to the merits, the complete intrinsic record alone demonstrates that the term provides sufficient guidance to a hypothetical person of ordinary skill in the art. The specification contains a wealth of detail. The prosecution history evidences that the term pan-fried bacon has an established meaning in the art and had that at the relevant time. The opinion says nothing about the prosecution history or much of the detail in the specification.
Well, let's turn to the specification then.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's a function, according to the specification, resembling pan-fried bacon product is a function of texture, mouthfeel, bite, appearance, or color. But it doesn't specify how to measure any of those characteristics, what level of them must be achieved, or how many of them must be met. So am I missing something that's in the specification?
Your Honor, I disagree with your premise. I don't believe that the specification says one has to focus analytically or quantitatively on the underlying organoleptic factors that together give a pan-fried bacon its appearance and flavor and taste.
Let me read you from the court's opinion at Appendix 29. The court says to your expert, and then if I just handed you two pieces of bacon, and I said, tell me, which one is microwave versus which one is pan fried? You wouldn't be able to do that. You would want to know which process each was made by, right? The witness. It would be difficult from two single pieces of bacon to say this is like pan fried and this is not like pan fried.
That I think, Your Honor, highlights the point of disagreement. This case is not about one piece of bacon compared to another piece of bacon. The claims define an industrial scale commercial product. We're talking about
your expert repeatedly testifies that the expert cannot tell the difference.
Well, what the expert was being cross-examined by the court, questioned by the court about these underlying factors. Those aren't relevant. The expert had previously offered testimony at appendix page A, 1018 and 1019, mm-hmm. paragraphs 8 through 10 of his reply declaration that said those underlying organoleptic factors really are not relevant to the inquiry of whether industrial scale production resembles a pan-fried bacon product.
Did you say 1018 to 1019?
1018, and I apologize because
Well,
what happened, Your Honor, is I noticed that after page 1014,
yeah.
In the reply declaration, it's still the reply declaration, yeah. The page numbers got garbled.
Oh, I see. So where should I be looking?
Paragraphs 8 through 10.
I see. Okay, so this is marked some kind of odd sequence of symbols, 30 and then 38.
It is, and I apologize. That didn't show up in the electronic record.
We are. Okay, so we're at page 4 of the reply declaration.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the district court focused on the required quantified criteria for the underlying factors. That's not what the patent disclosed. Let me point out.
Well, I guess the problem that if you walk away from the organoleptic factors and you say that those really aren't determinative, then how would I know that a particular piece of bacon is enough like pan-fried bacon in order to that my device that produced that piece of bacon would infringe?
Well, that would be the wrong comparison, Your Honor. Again, the claim.
Well, you agree that having pan-fried bacon is a substantive limitation of the claim, right?
Resembling a pan-fried bacon product is a substantive.
How would I know that a particular piece of bacon or a group of pieces of bacon produced by my machine resemble pan-fried bacon?
Here's how. First of all, we're talking about bacon slices that are input to a spiral oven at a rate of about 2.7 tons per hour. So we're not pulling one. We're talking about more
okay,
of an oven.
But suppose either one piece of bacon or 1,000 pieces of bacon. I still have to decide. This really is enough like pan-fried bacon that I'm infringing or not. How do I make that determination?
So several ways. First, the intrinsic record shows that pan-fried bacon is a term of art. Second,
what does it mean?
Well, it has, as the district court
said, other than bacon, which is fried in a pan.
And we had that discussion before the district court.
Yes,
and what the district court said as his ruling is if it's not indefinite, I construe that, have plain and ordinary meaning, and nothing more. That's at appendix 1925-1926. But to continue, the example, what the example does is it provides a point of comparison between bacon being made at 2.7 tons per hour against bacon that is pan-fried to 500 degrees for 2.5 minutes. And then the example says they are substantially the same. That is a point of comparison that a person of ordinary skill in the art would have in addition to understanding that the phrase pan-fried bacon is a term of art in the industry.
If bacon is pan-fried at 500 degrees, okay, a strip, okay, does it matter how often it's turned?
I suspect, Your Honor, the answer is it might matter not in a material way. It might, whether you leave it 2.5 minutes on one side or the other, or you flip it every minute, there might be an infinitesimal difference. Not a difference that a person of ordinary skill in the art would consider.
Is there something in the record that tells us that?
There is not on either side, because what the record shows is the example which says the bacon is going to be pan-fried at 500 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.5 minutes on one side, 2.5 minutes on the other. So that's what the record shows. And then the record says, and if you compare those products to what you've been making in the example at 2.7 tons per hour, you are going to find they are substantially the same.
But you're not limiting yourself, as I understand your position, at least before the district court, was you're not limiting yourself to example one. You don't say that example one is the definition of pan-fried bacon for purposes of this patent.
Well, that's absolutely correct. We are, it's
It is a precise comparison. But not a restrictive comparison.
Okay. Let me talk about some other comparisons. The summary of the invention, at column 2, lines 23 to 28, and then 32 to 34, talks about the range of colors that a product can have. But then it also says that the produced product does not have burned or blackened outer edges and is much closer than a microwaved product to a home fried bacon. What this teaches a person of ordinary skill is a three-way qualitative comparison. And it also teaches the boundary that the inventive pan-fried bacon cannot have burned or blackened edges. And one other...
Let me ask you a question. Yes, this is what's bothering me about this case, and just I'll lay it out for you. Okay. You and I are probably old enough, I suspect, to remember paint by numbers. You remember those games where you would color in the particular portions of the drawing, and it would sure enough turn out to look kind of like a painting?
Indeed.
Remember, okay. Suppose I come up with an improvement on paint by numbers, and I say, if you follow this, you will produce a painting that looks like the Mona Lisa. And then I get a patent on that. And one of the terms is it has to look like the Mona Lisa. Now, how in the world am I going to be able to enforce that patent for definiteness if no one really knows how close it has to be to the Mona Lisa? I have a data point, the Mona Lisa itself, but I don't know how far away from the Mona Lisa you can go and still infringe. That's my problem.
So
why is this case different from mine?
This case is different because, again, in addition to the one example, the bacon that we would be comparing is only compared if it meets claim limitations A through E. In other words, in order to be subject to the test of resembling a pan-fried bacon product, you first have to follow all the steps, and then you decide. You have the example. You have a pan-fried bacon as a term of art. You have the qualitative comparison and the summary of the invention. And again, a person of ordinary skill in the art would be able to understand within the range of flexibility we have under current law whether it resembles. No one challenged resembling as being vague. But the question was whether pan-fried bacon has meaning. And to me, the scope of resembling pan-fried bacon product is very similar to the kind of cases this court deals with substantially or similar. And so there's quite a few data points. Let me also say, there's no question, if one looks at the Hormel extrinsic evidence and the color photos, I mean, Hormel has been marketing and showing comparisons and using the phrase pan-fried bacon, showing pictures. The reality is that a person of ordinary skill in the art would well understand with the comparisons that are available what resembles a pan-fried bacon product after it's gone through the steps of process claims A through E, and what doesn't.
Okay. You're well into your rebuttal, so I'm here from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'd like to address two primary points.
Well, I want to start with this.
Certainly.
You seem to argue lack of finality below.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in its reply, HIP points to a letter from April 11, 2019, at Appendix 1133.
Yes.
In which, I assume this is Hormel, is it not?
It is, Your Honor.
To bring the case to finality, defendants agree that if the court expedites consideration on the indefinite issues and grants judgment in defendant's favor on its invalidity counterclaim and HIP's claims, defendants will dismiss the remaining inequitable conduct and correction of inventorship counterclaims and so on. Doesn't that wrap up the case?
Your Honor, it certainly did not wrap up the case at the time, and it's explicit here, Your Honor, and that's I think the point is. The parties understood, even back as far as April of 2019, that if the court issued an opinion finding the claims indefinite, then that is a partial summary judgment, and we agreed that if the court did that, we would then take steps to dismiss our claims so that final judgment could be entered. So even as early back as April of 2011, the parties understood that what the court was going to do...
And you did that, of course. You dismissed.
It took a while. It took a month. And in fact, what happened, Your Honor...
How is this different than our case in EPAS, which we followed in subsequent cases where the district court grants summary judgment of some of the claims, there's an appeal, and then the district court dismisses the remaining counterclaims and enters judgment, and we hold the premature notice of appeal ripened when the judgment was entered and cured any defect?
I think the difference between EPAS and this case, Your Honor, is in EPAS what the court did is it terminated the entire case, provided an appeal deadline, so everyone had a reasonable belief that the case was over. And it was that judgment that was appealed from. In this case...
But who had any doubt that the case was effectively over in this case, given that you had agreed to dismiss, the judge understood that, and the other party assumed that it would happen?
The other party, in fact, after this happened, the partial summary judgment was entered. The appeal was immediately taken, and it was immediately taken for a reason, Your Honor. It wasn't because we don't have, as First Tier points out, an inexperienced plaintiff with inexperienced trial counsel. They have very experienced trial counsel, and it wasn't a decision. The appeal wasn't filed because they thought it was final. The appeal was filed because they wanted to expedite this appeal because there's a parallel PTAB proceeding going on. So they wanted, and they in fact did, try to stay that appeal. So what they were doing was saying, let's crank this through as quick as we can.
So you made a representation.
Yes, and the
and you followed up on it.
And the week after they actually filed the appeal, within a week, we sent them a communication saying, that's not a final order. We need to work through and see if we can agree on
Where's
a stipulation.
That?
It's at, I'll tell you, Your Honor, 13, it's at the back, it's at Appendix 2335. Let's see. And if you'll see on Appendix 2335, towards the bottom of that, I say, Jerry, thanks for the letter. Go on. We wanted to raise another issue with you. We suspect the current appeal may be premature as the case was not final and no final judgment was entered. So basically, and then we provided them with a proposal. We spent almost a month having to negotiate that proposal because one of the other elements that the court didn't deal with was the infringement element. How exactly was infringement gone? How could it come back? So we spent almost a month before we got to final judgment. So the idea is even if they thought it was a final judgment when they filed it, which I don't believe they did, clearly, within that month after, we were negotiating all this. The court entered the final judgment we asked them to.
So?
And so the court has jurisdictional rules, and the jurisdictional rules say that you have to appeal from a final judgment. And Rule 4A2, as applied in the first tier case, Your Honor, it states that Rule 4A2 can save a premature appeal
only when a district court announces a decision that would be appealable if immediately followed by entry of judgment. There's no way that partial summary judgment ruling, absent a certification under Rule 34, was a final judgment that could have been appealed. Everyone knew it, both before and after. They had the final judgment in their hand. They had experienced counsel. They chose not to slow the appeal down by filing a new appeal.
Okay, let's talk about Bacon.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this was actually a great case for having an evidentiary hearing, because what we learned from that evidentiary hearing, and I think what you recognize today, is despite the fact we're standing before you today, I certainly don't know, and I expect no one knows, what the standard is for an expert to apply to determine whether pan-fried bacon...
It really doesn't matter, because their expert indicated he didn't know.
Exactly. And that's what the good thing was when the judge finally got to ask his own questions of the experts. And their own expert couldn't find it. Our expert certainly explained that it is purely a subjective term. And while in this case is really, really on all fours with the datamized case, because what you had in both of those cases, where you had some parameters laid out in the patent, but you had no way to define whether or not those parameters were met. And so just like datamize, this purely subjective term had no objective standard either within the patent, which both experts admit, that the plaintiff's expert admits that there's no objective standard laid out for those terms, and there's nothing in the art, he also admitted, their own expert admitted, that even in the art, there's no objective standard. With regard to Hormel's own use of the term, their expert was asked, well, how does Hormel apply it? He couldn't give a standard for Hormel's use either, because there is no standard, because this is purely subjective.
Let me ask you a question, which is a little bit out of the set of issues that the parties have addressed, but when I first read the claim, it struck me that the resembling a pan-fried product sounded like preamble-type language rather than substantive limitation-type language. Now, both parties have agreed that it is a substantive requirement. Is that because without that language being a substantive limitation, there would be invalidity problems with this claim?
Well, I think that's there certainly are invalidity problems with the claim regardless of that issue, Your Honor.
What I'm trying to get at is because if that language is not a substantive limitation of the claim, then the problem goes away. The problem of indefiniteness, right?
If that original order was different, we wouldn't have gone on to address the indefiniteness issue.
Right, but what I'm saying is that this you would agree with me, I think, that in many circumstances someone would be arguing that that language is really preamble language and not limiting, and that the limiting language shows up in A, B, C, D, and E of the claim, right?
Well, I can't attest to what people strategically
well,
would argue.
If you were in that position as a patent lawyer and you looked at this and you said, oh boy, if we have to deal with pan-fried bacon as a claim limitation, we're going to have a problem.
We're
and
fried.
Therefore, it looks like preamble type. That's a judgment that you might well reach, don't you think?
I guess I can't speculate that on,
okay,
on your
the,
own.
I think the point is... I know from the record that this was added during prosecution to overcome prior art, the limitations. Am I mistaken about that?
The limitation, while it was added during prosecution, that's correct. It did not overcome the prior art. They continued to get rejections.
But the intent, you think, was to overcome prior art.
Again, I can't speculate on the intent. I think the key here is regardless of that decision and what happened with that decision.
We all agree that it is limitation.
It's water under the bridge, Your Honor, and I don't think this court either has the jurisdiction given the scope of the notice of appeal or should, even if it had jurisdiction, address that, because that's a separate issue. That order was never appealed.
All right.
Only this order was.
That's fine.
I think the other point, unless you have any further questions on that issue, I'll go back to the indefiniteness issue. And I think the other point I just raised in response to my friend is that with regard to the example, as he noted, as you questioned, the example at its best presents one data point. He admits it doesn't provide the contours of the claim. And just as in Datamize, you can have one example, and unless, especially with purely subjective terms, unless you have something to bound that with substantial evidence, like, you know, the cases that have found that terms were not indefinite within the within the specifications themselves, there was sufficient data, many examples provided that helped guide one of ordinary skill in the art.
And I think you're being generous when you say at its best, but I'm just puzzled why you want to send this back down to the district court.
I don't want to send it back down to the district court, Your Honor.
Or you said it's prematurely appealed.
Oh, your argument, I take it, is that the appeal has been waived altogether.
Correct, Your Honor. We would ask that this case, that this appeal be dismissed and the case be final. We're not in any way asking that it be returned to the district court, and in fact believe. You know, we would just be right back up here if
you
that
would, with a 54B certification. So,
well, but I think the point is the case is over, and there was no appeal from that judgment. So we don't think that any remand is available. They couldn't go back and appeal. But regardless, Your Honor, if you're inclined to address the merits of this case, we certainly understand that. We think we are very strong on the merits. And
let me ask one more question along the lines of Judge Wallach's question, and that is, you mentioned earlier with respect to the dismissal issue that there was some complexity to be worked through with respect to the proposed order of dismissal. I think
yes.
You said something to that effect.
Yes.
And I'm looking at the proposed order of dismissal and entry of judgment, and two of the three paragraphs simply saying judgment is entered against the plaintiff because of the indefiniteness. And the other paragraph is simply says defendant's first counterclaim for inequitable conduct and third counterclaim for correction of inventorship are dismissed pursuant to the terms of the letter of the court. That doesn't sound very complicated to me. You're just doing exactly what you said you would do in the April letter. Why did that take a month or whatever?
Well, Your Honor, because that last paragraph is exactly that. What was it that we actually agreed to do in that letter? And we went back and forth on how that was to be interpreted in terms of if there was a remand, for example, exactly what claims we continued to have. And so we negotiated that, and that's where you got a simple result in the end, which was we said in our April letter what we said and basically left the decision of how that was going to be interpreted in terms of how any claims that were dismissed came back in the case. Your Honor, I think in conclusion, that, you know, the other point that we haven't talked about, but obviously this court is extremely well aware of this, is not only did the court get it right, but we are here under a standard of review, and based on the court's decision, its firsthand look at testimony, its credibility determinations of the witnesses, that we're here not just to say, was the court right or was the court wrong, but we're here to say, did the court clearly err in coming to its conclusions?
Well, in indefiniteness, it's sort of like the Teva principle, right? It's a question of law for the court, which is apply the legal standard and only if there are factual issues that are attendant to that determination does the clear error standard apply, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So that would apply, for example, to the assessment of the experts' credibility type decisions, but it strikes me not much else in the case has the clear error standard, right?
But the majority of this case, because there is no standard, objective standard within the four corners, the majority of the case is about evaluating what each of the experts believed was the state of the art. And in fact, HIPS own counsel stated that this isn't the typical case where you can just sort of on the four corners of the patent decide whether there's an indefiniteness issue. And it's important particularly here to have expert testimony. That's at Appendix 1893 to 95. And so this court went out of its way to have a full day testimonial hearing in order to understand these experts, not just on paper, but in writing. And he made those credibility determinations, and Your Honor, you're correct that if you look at his credibility determinations and you look at those for clear error, you look at what he decided based on that testimony, did he clearly come to the wrong factual conclusions of what the state of the art is? And then the question is, which you can look at de novo, based on those findings, did the district court properly conclude? Thank you, unless the court has any further questions.
Very briefly, Your Honors, I asked the court to take a look at appendix page 64, docket entry 142, and what the district court entered their order granting motion for summary judgment, patent invalid, then in all capital letters, case closed. That was June 24, 2019. Very much like the Pandrel case.
What entry is that?
It's 142 on appendix 64.
You know, I'm sure that normally those words, case closed, are put in by the clerk, not by the judge.
I do understand that, Your Honor, but That's the record that we had to work with, and it's consistent with how the district court understood it at the time. Judge Bryson, you'd asked a question about standard of review and in the line of demarcation, and what I would suggest is that Teva and Sonix drew a nuanced line that separates extrinsic evidence where the judge talked about underlying factual questions, but the judge erred as a matter of law in relying on conclusory allegations and the judge's own findings on ultimate issues, objective, subjective, are entitled to no deference at all. I do submit that the record, when it's fairly reviewed, has a comparison, has guidance from the two embodiments in the specification, has qualitative comparisons in the summary. The inventive process is much closer, to use its language, to pan-fried bacon than to microwave bacon. And a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand this, given that's shown by Hormel's own extrinsic records. Does the court have any questions?
No, thank you.
We thank you.
Both sides in the cases.